And we are live just a couple minutes early as I do a little mic adjustment here. It is a Monday. Welcome to another week. It is also my last full week before I'm gone on vacation. I'll be leaving next week toward the end of the week. And I'm going to Alaska on a boat. Actually a ship, a really big one. Dorothy has actually talked me into going on a cruise ship, which was never something that I was excited about. But I'm pretty excited about this. It's been a long time coming. We actually didn't take a big trip last year because we kind of went all out on this one and spent some of that moldy old money that we've socked aside for so many years. We're going to have a blast. We're going to go out on an island in a float plane and see bears and do some whale watching and really live it up, live the high life for about a week on this giant ship. And so I'll be gone and we'll leave you some rewinds or something like that. But just letting you know that in advance. And I think that's why Dorothy, for those of you on the video, Dorothy's having a little bit of a second thought on this Santa Claus beard thing. But I told her, you guys were like, no take backs. You don't get any take backs, Dorothy. Like I mentioned that last week that she was like, I don't know if I want you to do it. Like, it was her idea. She talked me into doing it. I'm in the middle of it now, and now she doesn't want it. It's like, no. We're going to go all out with Santa Claus Spirico this year. We're in that weird stage, though, where we haven't grown enough of the beard yet to kind of trim it into place, but I'm going to go see my haircut girl this week, too, and maybe she can make it look a little bit more presentable. I'm doing my best with it, but if you haven't heard me talk about that, that's why I look like this right now. I usually don't have this much of a beard, especially when the hair is, you know, pretty decent. Anyway, what are we going to talk about today? This is a Monday, so it's time for, you know, we pick our head up and look around and see what's going on out in the real world of current events. A little announcements, though, first, just to remind you, because I am going to be gone starting next week into the complete following week. We do have the workshop, the TSP 25 workshop, going on sale Saturday, I should always have the calendar up when I do this, because I always end up second-guessing myself. That will be, if this will cooperate with me over here on the other machine, that will be on Saturday the 13th of September. That's when the workshop will go on sale. You will need to be a member of the TSP Telegram chat or group, one or the other or both, because at 9 a.m., on Saturday the 18th, that's Central Time, I will drop a link to sign up into the Telegram channel. And if that lasts an hour, then I'll post it publicly on the blog. And I don't think it will, because last year we sold out in 2.5 minutes. No doubt. Now, we probably might take 10 minutes to sell out this year or something like that, because we're selling 35 more seats. But I still expect it will sell out very, very quickly. There's a lot of interest in it. So just a reminder of that. Additionally, on Monday, the 8th of September, the ChatGPT course goes on sale. And we'll be emailing that the list of pre-registered folks to remind you a couple times between now and then. But that went stupid fast. That was like, you guys broke the server and it still sold out in a few minutes. And Tom's got the server beefed up now for that particular application. And we'll be on the fly balancing things as they go. So that's probably going to sell out in a couple minutes too. And that's going to be $300. It's a 40-day course, 5 days a week, with Tom and I guiding you through a private Telegram chat. We give you a list of prompts and things to do for your business every day. And the first one of those went really well, so just a heads up on that. Moving on, though, let's talk about what we're going to actually dig into with today's show. Number one, I just saw a little video this morning on X, and it's a very pretty girl. Young girl, probably in her early 20s, and made up well and all. And surely whoever produced the video, I think Swan Bitcoin might have had something to do with it, but they were sharing it, not publishing it, so maybe not. I'm sure somebody gave this gal a script, and she did a really good job of reading it, and she may or may not know the material. I don't know. But whoever wrote the script, whether it's her or somebody else, holy crap, is it dead on. And this is the four primary characteristics that you need an asset to have to build wealth, and it's centuries old. It's centuries old, and I'm going to play it for you when we get started. Trading with your future self and how Bitcoin puts you in touch with it. I've said so many times since I heard it the first time, and I think it was Safe Dean Amos that I heard it from the first time. I'm not sure. But it's the most important trades you make are with future you. And you don't know it, but you're doing it every day. Every action you take today is a trade with future you. And I thought it was a great time to revisit that and follow up with that. You know, use it as a close down point for the video that I'm going to lead off with, because I think the two really put each other in perspective. Then, you know, there's, of course, the media says Putin won the summit, like as though there's a winner or loser in something like that. Anyway, the Orange Man met with Putin on Friday up in Alaska. Some good stuff came out of it. Some neutral stuff came out of it. Some negative stuff came out of it. It is what it is. But something that came out of it that nobody believed, and I said this would happen, and here it is now. Russia's okay with security guarantees for Ukraine. They just don't want Europe doing it. They want America doing it. In other words, they're okay with the United States locating U.S. troops inside Ukraine proper as a security guarantee for Ukraine. Because obviously then if Russia were to attack again, they would be doing a direct assault on the U.S. That ain't going to happen. Why would Putin and the Russians be okay with the U.S. doing that but not the EU? I just say look at the EU, but we'll talk about it. And then Ukraine says, we are going to give up no territory. We're not giving anything back, including the part we took. We want the part that Russia took from us back, but we're not even going to give them the part of Kursk that we stole, a little tiny sliver of Kursk we have. Yeah, bullshit. Ukraine will absolutely be giving up a significant amount of territory in these negotiations, and they're not going to have a choice. I'll explain why. Now, I got another one for you. The title of today's show is It's Worse Than You Think It Is. We all know that economically this country has real problems going forward. Whew. What I'm going to show you is an interview done a few months ago by Chris Martinson, and it's about the debt that the school systems have in this country. So that's just one piece of the many problems. And it focuses in on Texas. But that's just because the guy is doing all his work legislatively and judicially in the state of Texas because he's from Texas. So the examples he gives are Texas. But he says, I've basically examined the whole country. Every state has this problem, some far worse than Texas, and Texas is bad, really bad. How bad? We'll tell you. And it's going to be hard for some people to grok this. And it's exactly where I said that the eventual big problems for our country would come from. Municipal debt and school debt is just, you know, it's just one form of municipal debt, but it's the biggest one. And it is a sea of landmines, and each landmine is close enough to another landmine that when this one goes off, it can cause a chain reaction. And I think you'll come away from that with realizing that we have bigger problems than you think, and however much Bitcoin you have, you probably don't have enough. Gold! Okay, then get gold, right? Everybody that says that, do you have gold? No, well, then shut up. Either one. I'm telling you. Yeah. And then I have a question for you guys, and I got some mixed answers to this. I actually got very consistent answers on X and mixed answers on Facebook when I asked this. Do you think the people that pay for protests should be at least partially responsible for the damage that the protests cause? I mean, the example I gave when I asked the question was if I'm me and I hire a hitman to kill you and the hitman kills you and we both get caught, then I get charged for murder equally with the hitman because I funded it. And some people said, but that's the outcome you're looking for. I'm not so sure these people aren't looking for the outcome they're getting. But another way to put it is if I were to run a plumbing company and hire a person with a bad criminal background and not do anything to ensure that that person was vetted as being, you know, rehabilitated, and you called my company and I sent that plumber to your house and he did some bad things in your home, I would at least be partially culpable for doing that, for neglecting my responsibility to vet the person that I paid to go do a job for you. And there's another 100 examples I could give. We're going to go into this and why the people that were concerned, I think maybe you're right to be concerned, but you're ignoring the full context of what I gave you and how law works. Because law isn't a simple binary thing. It never is, even though some people try to make it out to be. And then, is it time to reevaluate the two-income family as the default? Not that, you know, women can't work or whatever, but like we live in a place now where it is the default position that when you get married, husband and wife are both going to work full time. That's the default position. Should it be the default position? You know that if we go back to 1975, and then we go back another 25 years to 1955, right? So that would be, what, 75 years from where we are right now? So from 75 to 50 years from where we are right now, that 25-year period, about 70% of families in America were single income. And many of the 30% that weren't single income, you know, mom had a part-time job. Mom worked a few hours during the week early in the day. Once the kids were in kindergarten and up, maybe mom took a job. Maybe mom worked at the school, whatever. And by the time the kids were out of school, well, mom wasn't working, right? Mom was home when the kids were home. And it was our generation, if you're my age, Generation X, you know, people that were born between 65 and 75, because 75 is when that number started to drastically go down, right? By the 1980s, when we were all running around as little savages, we all had a key to our house. They called us latchkey kids. That hasn't really benefited society very much. In fact, I don't know any way that society has benefited from this. So should we be reevaluating this? And are some people already doing it? And the Texas Democrats, they ran away because that's the only thing they know how to do. They've been running away, you know, consistently since 1994. They've been running away. Every time they know they're going to lose a vote in the House, they just run away. They're coming back because Abbott has made it very clear that he is going. That's Greg Abbott, for those that aren't from Texas, our governor. He has made it very clear that he will call session after session after session after they cannot run the clock out on this. He's like, I'll call session after session after session until, you know, time ends. You're not getting out of this. So I guess they decided they're heading back. I'm going to talk about that a little bit, but more, I'm going to tell you some dirty tricks the Republicans could play when the House reconvenes, but they won't do it. The thing is, I have no doubt if the situation was reversed, the Democrats would. I actually like in our country anyway, so I don't know about other people's countries, and they have their own versions of liberals and conservatives. But in the United States, the Republicans remind me a lot of the Federation in Star Trek, right? They think they're the good guys, and a lot of what they do is okay, but a lot of what they do isn't okay, but they're always playing by the rules, right? And whenever they come up, like diplomatically, you know, against the Romulans, they always get bent over hard, right? Because the Romulans, like, will use the rules against them and ignore the rules at the same time for themselves. And that's how I see Democrats in this country as a party, not as a people, right? I'm not talking about the guy from Nebraska that, you know, farms corn and votes Democrat. I'm not talking about him. I'm talking about the political parties themselves. The Democrats will bend and break every rule there is. And they will tell you to shut down, sit down, shut up, and accept it when they're in charge. And when they're out of charge, anything that's even a little bit pressing completely within the bounds of the rules the Republicans are doing, they're cheating, they're Nazis, they're authoritarian, whatever, right? Like, they lose their shit. It's pretty interesting. I'm just going to give you a couple tricks the Republicans could pull during the next session in the Texas House. And this is state legislature, for those that don't know. And they won't do it. They won't do it. They won't do it. They won't do it. But the Democrats would do it, right? Remember, the Democrats are the ones that talked about stacking the court, making D.C. and Puerto Rico states, all of that shit. When they were in power, they were talking about getting more power so they could do it. But now, one state redraws its lines 5 years early after having its population grow by 2 million freaking people, and it's the end of the republic. Yeah, okay. So we'll talk about all of that in just a moment. Before we do, let us go ahead and recognize our sponsors of the day. Sponsor of the day number one today is JM Bullion. JM Bullion has been a sponsor of the Survival Podcast since 2013. I looked it up today. 2013, that is 12 years in the world of podcasting. As I said, you're going to have a lot of reason looking forward. When I cover one of my segments today alone to why you should be holding real hard assets, monetary instruments, I personally have the vast majority of my surplus capital in Bitcoin. But I also have a significant amount of silver and gold. and I always will as a wealth assurance program. I recommend about 5% of your total net wealth in precious metals. That's your total net wealth. That includes like the equity in your home, right? Your total net worth, legitimate net worth, should be about 5% in silver. I'm okay in gold, and I'm okay with it being up to 10%. I think anything over that, you're overweighted. But most people are nowhere near close to that. And the best form of precious metal is precious metal you can hold, things you can put your hands on. I will also consider that a lot like Bitcoin, where I would rather you hold your own Bitcoin with private custody. But if you can't for any particular reason, the money can't get out of a 401k or something, and you have to use an ETF, I'm fine with that too. That's how I feel about silver and gold. There's nothing wrong with holding SLV or GLD. But if you have the ability to self-custody your gold and silver, do it, because it is the most anonymous form of wealth there really is. Next up today is the Berkey Guy at usaberkeyfilters.com. The Berkey Guy has been a sponsor on and off a couple times, but since like 2010 is when we signed Jeff the Berkey Guy Gleason the first time as a sponsor. That's a long time to be working somebody. That's 15 years. The Berkey water filter systems are, in my opinion, the best value for the money there is on the market. They really can't break. They really can't fail unless you do something really stupid with them, like, I don't know, don't tighten the filters up with the seals or something. They have no real moving parts. It's extremely inexpensive once you start using it. It's a very, very effective system. And you can get them from a lot of places, but Jeff the Berkey Guy is one of the top resellers for Berkey in the world. He's been doing business with them for decades, so if something goes wrong, he can help you out. Check it out today at usaberkeyfilters.com. And with that, let's get into the first story I got for you today. Again, this girl that they put in this video, I don't doubt for a minute that this gal was selected because she's easy on the eyes. And again, I know the temptation is to think this lady doesn't know anything about Bitcoin. Maybe she doesn't. I don't know. But what she says is spot on. And I wanted to let her talk, let you hear what she had to say, and then I'll come back and we'll talk about these four attributes, these four laws of wealth that have worked for, in this case of this post, it says 5,000 years.
These four wealth laws have worked for over 5,000 years. Bitcoin doesn't break them, but actually supercharges them. The first law being spend less than you actually earn. Bitcoin makes this extremely easy for us because it provides in us a low time preference mindset. When you're saving in the hardest asset ever created, you're less tempted to spend because every time you are, you're thinking, is this really worth this many satoshis? It somehow feels like you're stealing from your future self, therefore developing a low time preference. Second law being investing. Because Bitcoin is now the new hurdle rate, you're always asking yourself this question, does this investment beat Bitcoin? And should I risk my capital in anything? Will it be able to beat the hurdle rate, which is Bitcoin? It helps you make your investment decisions much easier. Third law being compounding. Bitcoin's fixed supply of 21 million creates a powerful deflationary compounding effect. As adoption grows, but the supply remains capped, early adopters benefit the most. The key insight here isn't to try and time the market, but try to compound and be as early as possible in the compounding process. Compounding your wealth in a deflationary asset at a younger age means that as you grow older over time, your assets will gain in value and help you towards a financially free future. And the fourth law is protect what you've built. Wealth is not only about generating more money, but protecting what you have and making sure that it doesn't disappear over time. A lot of the times, people who are managing lots of wealth, it's more about making sure that the next generation is able to continue to use this wealth. Bitcoin cannot be inflated and is the only form of money that you can truly own. They can't be taken away from you, can't be frozen. So as long as you understand these aspects and custody your own Bitcoin, not your keys, not your coins, you are then truly preserving your wealth and making sure that no one can take this away from you. These laws in preserving and generating wealth apply to most assets, but now with Bitcoin in the picture, amplifies it.
So, like I said, I personally thought that that was spot on. And there's a couple of those attributes that I would like to specifically pull out and dig into. And one is compounding, because I think compounding is something that anybody with any basic fundamental understanding of investing or borrowing kind of gets. But Bitcoin turns compounding upside down. It really does. And this is how I mean that. What most people think of with compounding is if I buy, let's buy something boring, a 4.5% interest bond. And if I want a yield from that, that means if I put in, $1 million and I get 4.5% out, I get $45,000 a year in income to me that spits out. So the bond remains a $1 million bond and I can take a 4.5% yield out. If I want to maximize my returns, and most people do this with their dividend stocks and everything else, their 401k, then I leave the money in there and I reinvest it. This used to be commonly referred to as drip with stocks. You could buy stocks directly. I think you still can, but nobody does it anymore. But way back in the day, like, you could buy a stock like McDonald's or Exxon or whatever that paid a dividend. And you could, and a lot of, like, grandparents from the silent generation and back did this for grandchildren. You'd get like $1,500 and I'm going to give it to the kid. But I don't want to put it in a bond because it doesn't pay enough. So they would put it into a DRIP program, a dividend reinvestment program. And then, every year that Exxon paid out that dividend to shareholders, the dividend would just buy more stock and would compound that way. And so the way people tend to think of an asset and compounding is and this is one of the criticisms that the uninitiated have of Bitcoin is, well, it doesn't have a yield. And what they mean by that is it doesn't spit out a dividend that I can take and spend or I can compound with. It doesn't have to. It doesn't have to. Unlike just about everything else on the planet, Bitcoin actually has a fixed cap. There's only so much of it. This creates a mathematical certainty of guaranteed upward pressure on price. And you can doubt that all you want. And when you doubted it, in 2014, I didn't agree with you, but I said, I understand why you doubt it. At this point, it's going up forever, Laura. Okay? To quote Michael Saylor, it's going up forever, Laura. And what that means is that, it'll go up and down over, let's say, a 3 or 4 month period. But if you measure it over multiples of years, it only goes up. And that means that the earlier, is what she was trying to get across, the earlier you buy it and the more frequently you buy it, the more you compound the return, because as the asset price goes up, your increase in net worth is directly correlated to how many units of the underlying asset you have. You see how simple that is? Maybe it doesn't sound simple, but it really is. And the ability to acquire more continues to decline. It continues to decline. I'll put it this way. Let's not go back to the very Genesis block or something. Let's just go back to like 2020 when Bitcoin was like 10 grand and now it's like $1.15 or something, right? You go back 5 years. How hard was it? And if you look, there has been wage growth. Most of you probably earn more money than you did in 2020. If not, I'm sorry, but you should, right? There should be wage growth because you get a raise, you get a new job, you work harder, some level of wage appreciation, right? But you can't buy more Bitcoin than you could then, can you? See, that's compounding in a deflationary asset. The reason it doesn't go in your head as compounding is, what other deflationary assets do we have? Even gold and silver, which I have a tremendous respect for, and I just said, I hold quite a bit of it, they're not deflationary. They're highly limited inflationary assets due to their stock-to-flow ratio, meaning there's so much gold that even though we produce a lot of gold every year, it's very difficult for us to produce more than about 1% to 2% of the existing supply, so it's a very controlled inflation. A person that knows Bitcoin well would say, well, Bitcoin, same. Yeah, but Bitcoin production continues to dwindle, guaranteed, while the existing stock continues to grow. And so the ratio between the new Bitcoin and the old Bitcoin keeps getting smaller. And it's so small already as to be almost completely irrelevant. mining Bitcoin block rewards right now pretty much do one thing: pay miners to mine and secure the network. And more that's falling over to fees are actually paying the miners, as the Bitcoin that the users pay to have miners secure the network becomes worth more money. And so there's a compounding effect with a deflationary asset. And it does exist with gold and silver, but not on this level, and it never can. It's impossible. Because we can produce more gold and silver if we want to. But Bitcoin, we already know that pretty much the day that the last one will be mined, the last Satoshi will be mined. Miners, not miners. Okay. Anyway, the other one that I wanted to hit on in that video was protection, because it's going to lead right to my next segment. There is this concept that they call toxic maxis, right? Toxic maxis. And those are people that just seem like they're nasty when you bring up anything. They're like, but what about Litecoin? Shut up. Have fun staying poor, you moron shitcoiner, right? But they don't get where most of those people come from. They don't. Most of the people that are that way are not people that found Bitcoin like in 2022 because they saw a Michael Saylor video and they became a pleb and went all in. Most of those people like me, we're old, we're graybeards, been around a while. We lived through the block wars. We've seen a war. We've seen somebody come after our asset. We saw it done at a level that'll never happen again, but we remember it happening. We're kind of like old timers that were old enough to remember like the Civil War and a young person that wasn't, even if they were alive, like in, let's say, early 1900s. Maybe that young person was alive, but they don't really have a memory of it because they were too young when it happened in the 1860s. So we remember that war. We remember Roger Ver. We remember Craig Wright. So when one of you come to us and go, did you mean hijacking Bitcoin? We're like, shut up, shitcoiner. Because we don't need a book to tell us what happened. We lived through it. We were here. We were part of it. But we've also seen our wealth grow because of this asset, and we're very protective of it. But we're even more protective of our share of it because we know the asset itself, Bitcoin, needs Jack Spirico very, very little. But my Bitcoin that I hold, I'm extremely protective. I'm extremely guarded with it. I don't want to spend it. Like, I go, we have to spend it. We have to spend it. Spend yours and shut up about mine, okay? I was spending Bitcoin before you knew what it was. I've spent enough. I'm done. I learned my lesson. Go learn your own lesson and stop telling other people what to do with their money, no matter what form it's in, okay? You start protecting your wealth. Protection of your personal wealth is what that gal was on about. In other words, I am going to make sure that I don't lose this. I am going to, I'm going to guard this jealously. And it's something that we actually really need in our country right now is people to have more appreciation for the value of money. Right? I guess a lot of you are, you know, a bit younger than me. So you didn't have grandparents that were quite as old as my grandparents. You know, you didn't have grandparents who lived through the Great Depression. And because of that, you really haven't had anybody in your life that was ultra guarded with the preservation of money. Like people that will literally like, ah, that aluminum foil's not so bad. Let's rinse it off and fold it up and we'll use it again. Right? Oh, look, that's a food grade container. It's a milk jug. We'll rinse the milk out of it, fill it with water and freeze something in it. Right? Like that kind of thing. Or you go into my grandfather's shop and all the little screws, nuts and bolts are all in baby food jars with the tops of the jars screwed up to the bottom of the cabinet, and then you just unscrewed it and got your stuff out of it, right? Like, they didn't throw shit away that had a purpose. But they weren't hoarders and junk men, right? Hudson says that's still me. I get it. Still me, too. But I'm looking at his picture going, we're old enough to both have grandparents like I'm talking about, right? Most people didn't that are running around today. Or they just kind of didn't pay attention. Like, we were weird. We paid attention to what the old people said. We, you know, a lot of us that are like this today, we're the people that spent way more time with our grandparents than our parents. And so we've seen wealth protected, even if the people that we watched do it didn't have much. They actually felt like the less wealth you had, the more important it was to protect it. And what that leads to is going, I want that. I could buy that, but what does it mean if I do? That one question is something we do not ask enough of in America today. But what does it mean if I buy it? Most people, can I afford the thing? Like, if I buy this today, will I be broke tomorrow? Okay. Or if it's a big purchase, can I afford the payment? That's the only question they ask. But what happens if I do it, and what happens if I don't do it? When you start holding Bitcoin, you start asking that question. One of the reasons we so freely spend money, whether we grok it or not, whether we articulate it or not, we know full well, and I mean we know full well, that that money will be worth less tomorrow than it is today. We know this. We don't think this. We know this. The people in charge of the money have a stated goal, to make sure the money is worth less. In other words, that's called a target inflation rate of the Fed of 2 to 2.5%, which is usually 4 to 4.5% by their numbers, even though they lie about it. And if you look at the real number, it's more like 8 to 12 sustained across time. So history and their own edict and their own words and their own charters say, your money shall be worth less tomorrow than it is today. And that forces two things to happen. Three things, really. One, people piss away their money because why not? It's going to be worth less. And if you ever want to see proof of that, look at a place where money starts to hyperinflate. People spend it as fast as they can in that situation because it will be tomorrow when it's worth less, right? Another thing it leads to is debt. Well, if I can get debt lower than the rate of inflation, then I win. Very simple, easy to understand mathematics. And it also leads to risk. The money I do save, since I already pissed away so much of it and blew so much of it on debt, I have so little of it for it to add up, accrue, and matter, I have to take significant risk buying stocks and bonds and ETFs, mutual funds, etc. So it leads to those behaviors. Where a depreciating asset leads to a conservative approach, not politically conservative economically. I don't want to spend it. And so one of the things I've started doing a long time ago, but I really do it a lot today, is anything I'm going to buy, how many Satoshis is that? And how many Satoshis was it 5 years ago? And it's amazing how many times you go, yeah, I don't need that. I just don't need that. Because I'm not seeing what I'm spending today. I see what I'm spending today as it will impact me tomorrow. That brings me to my next segment. This is such an important thing to understand because it's true even if the money is inflationary. It's just more true when the money is deflationary. Every decision you make that impacts you economically today, and not just economically like health and other things too, but especially economically, every trade you make today is a trade with your future self. And you might not really see where I'm going with when I say every trade. I mean, when you go down to the store and you find a widget you like, a green sexy widget. I don't know what it is, because if I say something you wouldn't buy, then you're going to tell me I wouldn't buy it anyway. And if I tell you something you would buy, you're like, screw you, I'll buy as many of those as I want. So it's just a green widget that you really like. And you decide to buy it. And you buy it from the green widget company. You think you made a trade between yourself and the green widget company. You made a three-party trade. Current person, yourself, current Jack, right, or current Ashley, or current Jeff, or current Divine Fungi, right, all these people in the chat, current version of you, the Green Widget Corporation, and future you. And how many future yous are there? There's 5-year future you and 10-year future you and 15 future you. And this is why we kind of should open up and spend more and work less and enjoy our retirement or partial retirement, even though I don't like the word retirement, like those end years of our lives, our last 10, 15, 20 years, since there's less future me's to make a deal with, then I might want to focus more on me. But when you're like 15, 20, 25, 30, There's a lot of future use, hopefully. You need to be thinking about those future use. Nothing I've seen puts people more in touch with it than Bitcoin, because it happens quickly enough for the person to feel their mistake. What you learn the most from in Bitcoin, and this is why spending it, at least for some people at some point, may not be a terrible thing if you haven't learned this lesson yet, is when you do spend it, and in only 5 years you go, "But that was stupid. That was dumb. Why did I do that? Why do I have a Belgian A5 pre-World War II Browning shotgun?" Belgian-made Browning A5 shotgun, made in 1930s, gorgeous gun. Paid $600 for it, because that was the price of Bitcoin at the time I bought it. It was worth about $1,300 then. Right now, it's probably worth close to $3,000, but I got about if I go and look at it the way I'm talking about now, that future Jack, I made the trade with me, a guy named Jesse, a future Jack. And future Jack lost over $100,000 at least in that trade. And when you've made that trade, that's when all these people, all these influencers, right, all these people that you know have only been around about 5 years, but they have like a catchy handle and a cool name, and they write cool tweets, and they have a cool podcast, and blah, blah, blah. We need to spend Bitcoin. We need to spend Bitcoin. We need to spend Bitcoin. I spent enough of my freaking Bitcoin, bro. I probably spent more Bitcoin than you own. Sit down, if we're talking raw sats. When you get in touch with this, you become much better about protecting and guarding your wealth. Back to the compounding and the protection and the gardening and the future trade. So let's move on from there. Let's talk about Russia. Russia, Russia, Russia. So Putin and the Orange Man met up in Alaska, and they parked a bunch of F-22s on both sides. So Putin has to walk in between the F-22s. And then as they're approaching the end of the red carpet, here comes a B-2 with four fighters escorting it. Just sails right over Vlad's head. Everybody's like, "America is showing its dominance. This is so wonderful." Please remember that, because the Orange Man probably will go to Russia, and they might fly some planes over his head. So I'm just saying, if you're okay with that, then you better be okay with the other one, right? But all this shit's coming out of this, and the political commentators immediately. First of all, Trump was involved, so it's wrong. It doesn't matter what happened. The facts, don't let the facts get in the way of the story, right? Like, it's bad. It has to be bad. Orange Man bad. So I really don't care what any of them are saying. I care what actually is coming out of the meeting and what it means to the future. And I don't care the way I think it should be. I don't care the way I think it should be now. And I don't think I care about how I think it should end up. It's irrelevant, because I am not important enough to change the outcome. And neither are you. And nobody that listens to me is important enough to have any impact on the outcome. I don't care how many posts you make. I don't care how many blogs you write. I don't care what kind of shit you say on your podcast or whatever. Like, none of us are going to have a single rat's hair, ass hair of impact on how this goes forward. All we can do is look at what all sides are saying, what all sides agree and have conflict with, and then say the most probable outcome is, and then say why. Then we can understand it, and then we can better prepare to deal with the consequences of it. So one of the things that came out of this, and this is really kind of weird, this is one of those things I wish I was on better on record with, but I mean, I literally said to my wife that morning, I bet Putin's going to say, if you want a security guarantee, do it yourself. I don't trust the European Union. It is one of those things, like a lot of times when I can say something like that's going to happen, I can tell you why beforehand. This makes perfect sense to me, but I never thought, you know, like really, you know, I always doubted my viewpoint on this, I guess I'm saying. Russia's okay with U.S. security in Ukraine. Now, what that means is that Russia's okay with a United States-led, in fact, United States-only peacekeeping force, armed United States military personnel permanently stationed at a base, let's say, or couple of bases in Ukraine. The original proposal was for the EU and NATO to take up this role. Now, of course, there is a red line here for the Russians. So that's the first part of it. No NATO. Ukraine is not NATO. It cannot be NATO. It will never be NATO. We will blow it to shit before we let it become NATO. And if it was Mexico on the U.S., Texas, and California and Arizona borders, and the Cold War was still going on, and Mexico was going to join the Warsaw Pact, you can bet your ass we would have the same opinion. You could totally understand Russia feeling that way. It's not Russia that put their borders in touch with NATO. It's NATO that did the opposite. So I understand that. The problem is that the U.S. is the big dog. Everybody knows it. And NATO has the Article 5 concept that if you're attacked, the other NATO nations have to come to you. So why would you trust America, which is a NATO nation, but you wouldn't trust the EU that's a NATO nation? Because the EU really is NATO when it comes down to it. The U.S. pays a lot of bills, and we sit back as the big dog that could smack the shit out of people. But in the end, the people that run and order and control NATO is Europe. And Europe is not to be trusted. So by allowing U.S. troops independently with no other NATO troops into Ukraine, what Putin's saying is, look, I want to take away your concern, all this bullshit you're hearing on your TV, that it's Russia's goal to take over all of Ukraine. Because if it was Russia's goal to take all of Ukraine would be getting hammered every fucking day with Russian military might, period. So I'm okay with the U.S. there because I don't think you'll do anything stupid. But if you say NATO troops, that can be all kinds of countries sending their idiots in there. You know, Turkey is a NATO nation. France, Germany, Belgium, the UK, right? Like all these countries. And like having this multi-faceted force that leads to potential miscommunication. And let's just be honest, there are countries in Europe that seem to want war with Russia more than they want anything else in their stocking for Christmas. They want a war with Russia. I don't know if John Bolton hired a voodoo shaman who like poked holes in Ursula's ass, right, or something, and made them want war. But they do. They want to start a war with really one of the, you know, there's really three superpowers in the world: us, China, and Russia. And when it comes to nuclear capability and military capability, it's really us, Russia, and then China, right? So you're picking the second strongest dog in the fight to try to pick a fight with because you think you have the first. And they don't trust. And honestly, the other reason I wouldn't trust Europe, the United States has a habit of sticking our nose in a lot of people's business we shouldn't. But we also don't have a habit of, like, starting wars in our own backyard over and over and over and over and over again. Europe does. Europe can't go very long without a conflict somewhere in Europe. So then you have this NATO coalition made up of nations that don't always get along. Some of them are very aggressive. Some of them are very conniving. And I think Putin wants out of this conflict. He wants this over. He wants this done. But he's not willing to give shit up just to do it. So I think he realizes, like, there is no – I don't think it's like he's excited about it, or even the Russian government is excited about having U.S. troops on the ground in Ukraine. But here's a couple things with that. Number one, there ain't shit he can do about it anyway. We've had U.S. troops training with Ukrainian troops for a long fucking time, right? So, like, you know, there's been U.S. troops in Ukraine anyway. And if we say we're going to put troops on the ground, there's nothing that Russia really can do about it other than engage us in conflict, which neither side wants. Well, if they do NATO, they'll probably be U.S. troops will be part of it anyway. So if he makes the concession, sure, but only you, that's the best of a bad situation. He's picked the least stinky shirt in the hamper yet again. Like, I don't want this, but it's better than all the other alternatives. It also puts a lot of pressure on Zelensky in Ukraine. Because Archman's like, wait, you said you needed security guarantees. And Putin's like, no NATO. And Trump's like, yeah, we're in. We're going to help. No NATO for you. You don't need NATO. You got us. Why would you need NATO? You got us. You got us. You, by proxy, have NATO anyway. So you see how that works. It's a very strategic move. And I don't think it's Putin's move. I don't think it's Trump's move. I think it's a Putin-Trump move. I think they came to this together, and I think they had this agreement before they ever met. I think most of what came out of there, we already knew was going to come out of there. I think all this uncertainty, and we don't know, and I might walk out in 2 minutes, you don't go to that level of a meeting with people at that high of a level until you've already hammered everything out through back channels. So you might have one or two sticking points left, but 99% of the work is done before you have that engagement. So I think that's why U.S. is okay with U.S. security, but not NATO security. Now, Ukraine, Zelensky's like, we're not giving up any land. Yes, you are. Yes, you are. Yes, you are. And every time anybody brings up Crimea, it's just shut up. Shut up. This has been since 2014. Russia took it over without a shot. There was a 96% vote by the people of Crimea to be part of Russia. It's never going back. It was never going to happen. How it's even in the discussion at this point, I don't know. Delusional, mentally ill people that want to raise conflict and war for others. That's all I can see doing that. But this whole shit storm started over the Donbass. And Donetsk and Luhansk, I think is how you say the two provinces that are particularly a hotbed here. And when we got rid of, and I say we, the United States, orchestrated a color revolution to oust a newly and duly and legally elected president, we did that. We caused that to happen. It was us. It was Lindsey Graham. It was John McCain. It was Amy Klobuchar. It was bipartisan. They went over there and they were part of a CIA op and they instigated this overthrow because the new Ukrainian president was open to having a good relationship with Russia. Not joining Russia, not reconstituting the Soviet Union or some other stupid bullshit. Just like, hey, we should have trade with Europe and Russia. Europe's on one side, Russia's on the other. We have a long history with Russia. They don't seem to be causing us any problems. Why can't we all get along? This dude was Rodney King. So they killed him, right? You know, they got rid of him. They beat him for real and got rid of him and threw him out. And they installed another president, and another president led to eventually Zelensky. That's what happened. And this whole current situation, the whole media acts like everybody in Ukraine was just happy. Everything was fine. There was peace. They were all holding hands and singing Kumbaya. And then one day, for no reason at all, because he's crazy, Putin just decides, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to invade a neighboring country because I want the Soviet Union back, which is not what Putin wants in any way, shape, or form. That's not what happened. Those two particular regions were a huge voting block for this. It was Poroshenko, I think, was the president I'm thinking of. But they voted huge, like 90-something percent for that. And they got their guy. They got their guy. And they're like, okay, good. This is good for us. We live on the border with Russia. Many of us are Russians. We travel back and forth across the border. We have family there. They have family here. This is great. We have a say in how things are going to be, and our life should be peaceful. These are mostly mining towns. This is blue-collar as blue-collar gets, these people are. And then the United States put their thumb on the scale and threw their guy out. And they're like, oh, hell to the no. I don't know if you've ever dealt with people and been around people that go down in mines to earn their living. They are not people that you fuck with, okay? I'm just telling you, these are not, and I don't care if it's China, I don't care if it's Ukraine, I don't care if it's Russia, I don't care if it's Germany, I don't care if it's the United Kingdom, I don't care if it's America or South America, whatever. People that will go down in a hole in the ground and pull, you know, coal and iron and copper and rare earths out of the ground, these are not people that you take lightly when you fuck with them. They get pissed. This caused a separatist movement in the Donbass, particularly three provinces, but really specifically the two that I mentioned earlier. This created a civil war. To head off the Civil War, the United States stuck their thumb on the scale again. We did something called the Minsk Accords, where the Ukrainians promised the people of the Donbass a certain limited amount of autonomy. Basically, run your own ship, you stay part of Ukraine, you pay our taxes, you get our civil services, but, you know, look at it like we'll treat you like states in the United States were treated before the Civil War. That's another thing Americans are not touching with our own history. Like, going from Virginia to Pennsylvania meant a hell of a lot more in 1850 than it did in 1870. A hell of a lot more. There was a lot less control federally of the Union. And so that was the deal that was made. Basically, you get to be like a state in the antebellum period, the pre-antebellum period of the United States, right? Like, that's what you get to be. And immediately violated it in every conceivable fucking way and waged a civil war on the border of Russia. Putin, who is the big villain in all this, is Putin's tax and Putin's, you know, war, but didn't even want to get in the war when he did. The people of Donbass begged Russia to do something to help them. Russia's parliament basically forced Putin's hand and made him invade Ukraine. And what they did is they took the area plus more, and they have done so with immense military power. And Ukraine has no military way out of this war. They don't. Doesn't exist. If Russia wanted to, they could press a lot harder. They could choke off so much in Ukraine. They have so wanted to stay out of war with the United States and the EU that they've confined almost all their activity to this strip. Now, they ended up taking more. They basically went all the way down and linked. There's basically a land bridge now between the Donbass and Crimea. That's going to be tough to leverage out of Putin's hand. I do think he may be willing to give some of it up. But what Russia's saying is, we want all the territory we have. Plus, since we have this province, and this province said it wants to be part of Russia, we want the little piece of the province that the Ukrainians are still keeping us out of. That's not fucking happening either. And we want Kursk back. And so we want our land back, and we want land we didn't even take as a concession from Ukraine, and then we'll go to peace. Well, that's not going to happen either. But I think that Putin maybe learned a little bit from Trump about the art of the deal. You have to ask for more than you want. Now, I think what Ukraine is asking for is still the Lulu. It really is. And I think if you watched at all the meeting today with Trump and Zelensky, he looks like a shell, a broken-ass man. I think he just got the talk. And they're like, you can keep talking all your shit publicly, but we're going to tell you backdoor what's going to happen. Because this is how the U.S. does business. We're like the fucking mob, man, when it comes to stuff like this. We're like, you will continue to fight the war? I don't want to fight the war. I want to make a deal. No, you're going to continue. You owe me, big buddy. You're going to continue to fight. Okay, I'll do it. Okay, now you're going to quit fighting. But now I don't want to quit fighting. Yeah, but you're going to do it. Vito, explain it to him. Explain it to him. Get Pesci over here. Put his head in a vice. Like, that's who we are. We're freaking gangsters of the world. I'm not saying that with any pride. I'm saying it with just reality. So Zelensky is going to have to give up territory. Russia needs to ask for more than they're going to get, so it looks like in the final deal they gave something up. That's what's going on here. We're going to move toward peace very quickly now. Very quickly. I don't think there will be a war by the end of the year. And in a scale of something like this, that's very, very quickly. And so the final outcome is this. There will be U.S. security on the ground in Ukraine. It will be a huge part of how the United States completely financially dominates the region. BlackRock et al. Will be in Ukraine rebuilding it. A massive flood of European, North African immigrants are going to be dumped into Ukraine to do all the shit labor because all the Ukrainian young men are dead. Russia gets the peace that I said they would get the day that the invasion started. And we are going to become an incredible trading partner with Ukraine? No. Europe? No. Russia. Trump is going to use this to peel Russia off of China. That is the big goal here. If you have enough going on positively with Russia, your need to deal with China goes down. They're already trying to isolate China. They're basically, they keep threatening these huge tariffs, but they call them the chicken tariffs, right? Because President Trump says he's going to do it, but he gives them another little bit of time. They're basically forestalling dealing with China until they get everything else done. They're putting a net around China, a moat around China, and they're going to isolate the shit out of China, and then they're going to turn up the pressure and say, these are the terms we want if you want to continue to be our most our highest value trading partner. That's what's going to happen. If everything works, I'm giving you the plan. I'm not telling you it's necessarily going to work, but that's the plan. And I think this is what's going to happen, seriously. If Zelensky doesn't get on board with this, Zelensky's going to find himself somehow ousted. So you don't believe that the 2014 color revolution can happen again. You don't understand the United States and our method, you know, our modus operandi. Don't think that we might not, you know, talk to a few Ukrainian commanders and go, hey, man, some stuff's about to happen, and you need to just sit this one out. You know, if when it's all over, you still want to be a general in the Ukrainian army, and you still want those big fat contracts, and you still want that all to happen, then you need to just take your troops and go on leave for a while over in the western part of the country, a little, you know, 200 miles west of Kyiv. Just don't be there. And you could see Zelensky and his henchmen hang from light posts or be chased out or potentially just, hey, Zelensky, bro, you know, all that additional documentation we gave you, you know, we gave you U.S. citizenship. We gave you citizenship in a couple other countries, too. You got all this money socked away. You got that big old yacht sitting out there. You might want to go use that now before you don't have it anymore. One way or another, he's either going to play ball or he's going to get ejected like an umpire ejects you on a tech foul. That's what's going to happen. So watch, and if you doubt me, that's what's going to happen. It is going to happen. Next up, I want to talk to you about something that I did talk about in the past. I talked about this a long time ago, municipal defaults. And I think one of the things people don't understand about municipal defaults is how they're different from a federal default on the debt. So we all know the U.S. owes like $37 trillion in debt, and it can't be paid. But the thing about it is the entire global economic system runs on debt, and the most wealthy country, as stupid as it is. Again, this isn't what I want to be true. This is what is true. Today, as things stand, until there's a momentous shift in the economic paradigm of the world, which ain't happening yet, the country that owes the most money is the wealthiest country. Money is debt, therefore whoever has the most debt has the most money. There's also a reality to that that I don't think people get. There's an old saying, if I owe you $300, I have a problem. If I owe you $3 million, you have a problem. You have the problem. Because if you do something that prevents me from servicing the debt, even though I can never fully repay it, you've lost all your money. That's where the U.S. sits in the global economic system right now. All these countries that are like, we'll put the screws in the United States, we don't need them, blah, blah, blah. Bro, okay, you know what? I just don't think we're going to pay the bonds to Germany then. Right, we got all these other people that are working with us and you're not, so we'll just discharge your bonds. Your credit rating, we don't give a fuck. We own everything. We have enough weaponry to annihilate the Earth 6 times over before we wake up in the morning. We have a blue water navy. We have aircraft carriers everywhere. We got assets all over the world. We got massive natural resources. Everybody owes us money, too. Everybody owes us debts, too. We owe everybody else. They're all kind. We're just not going to, and nobody wants to be that person. I know that sounds ridiculous, but it is the way that it is. We are like the mob boss that owes everybody money, but nobody can collect it. And they're grateful for the pittance they get in what we owe them. An offer you can't refuse. That's who we are. Municipalities, no. Because the one thing the federal government has, and I'm not saying this is a good thing, but it's a true thing, they have the power of the printing press. They can print money. They don't even have to print the money. They don't have to go. They can literally make money on a computer screen. They just say deposit to the account of the United States government, $1 trillion extra dollars. And all of a sudden the money's there. Yes, it devalues the money. Yes, it has problems. I'm not saying it doesn't. What I'm saying is any debt can be fulfilled by the printer. There is no foreclosure. Here's the money. But I don't like the money anymore. We don't care if you don't like the money. It loses value. I don't care. The contract was for dollars. The contract says we owe you $800 billion. Here's your $800 billion. Piss off. Nothing you can do about it. Again, I'm not propping that system up. I'm just saying that's how it is. So I want you to get the contrast. the school district of a little city called Azle up here does not have the ability to print money, but they're printing money. This is very dangerous when somebody without the ability to print money is printing money. I'll explain how in just a second. Fort Worth Independent School District does not have the ability to print money, but they're printing money. The City of Chicago School District does not have the ability to print money, but they're printing money. But they can't print money endlessly. You ever notice like your state never has a debt ceiling vote showdown or whatever? That's because they have a debt ceiling in it that they can only borrow money from people that will lend the money. They can't print money and lend it to themselves. States, cities, counties can't do this. How can a school district print money if they don't have the power to print money? Oh, dear friends, it's called a bond. It's called a bond. You know them as bond initiatives. The students need, fill in some savvy bullshit excuse here, and we need to make sure we provide it, and we are preparing for the jobs of the future. As asinine as it is, they say it, and hook, line, and sinker, like a bunch of dumbass fish, jerked up in the boat, clubbed in the head, they vote yes on the ballot initiative. I'm going to tell you what's coming soon to a land near you. Voters, if you don't vote yes on the bond initiative, the school that your little Johnny and Susie go to will go bankrupt and close down, and it will all be your fault. But it doesn't have to. All you have to do is vote yes. Now, how do these institutions gain credit? So first, the voters have to approve the bonds, which they do with no idea of what they're doing. Because an education is priceless, and every child needs to go to good education and all the bullshit, right? Think of the children. So they all vote yes. But then why do the people with the money buy the bonds? What is the credit extended against? The school building? Like when you build a house, your house is a big part of the collateral, right? Do you think that what is a – let's say somebody builds a $50 million school, big school, beautiful, great Votech shop and everything, you know, gym and a stadium and all. Is anybody going to pay $50 million for it other than the school? Like if I put in a big warehouse, it is an asset that I can sell to another company that needs a warehouse. If I put in a factory, I can sell to another company that needs a factory. There's no companies that need schools like this. If you can't believe some of the schools they're building in some of these cities and towns now, and I'm not talking Fort Worth and Dallas. You know, I'm talking like Frisco, Texas. It's a pretty big and wealthy city, but it ain't like a big city. And they have freaking high schools that look better than any college that existed, you know, 50 years ago. Way better. Unbelievable. Computer labs and automotive shops and fitness centers. And like the place the football team's working out looks like professional athletes would use it. They're doing it all with these bonds. But you can't sell it. You could sell it off in pieces and parts, but whatever the city paid to build that thing, it doesn't have enough value in the open market to act as collateral, especially after they build it and they want new buses and all this other shit. Like, there's not enough collateral to cover. What is the money being lent against? Property within the district. That's your house. The school district says we can service the debt because this is our income from property taxes. And when the people buying the bonds, because this isn't Grandma Jones buying the bonds. This is a BlackRock buying the bonds, okay? They say, well, when we look at this, once we add this debt to your stack and we look 4 years into it, you can't service the debt anymore. And they go, here's our plan to raise property taxes. And they go, here you go. There's a problem. The amount of flow from the property taxes can't possibly cover the debt. It can't. I'm going to bring up a video. I'm going to play a little bit of it for you. I really haven't decided how much of the video I'm going to play for you. I'm going to listen to it with you, but I've got it to a part where we've kind of gotten through all the intros and stuff. This is with Chris Martinson, who I really like. He's been on the show a couple times, with a guy named Mitch Vexler, who's doing some really good work at uncovering all of this stuff, But let me just play you a little bit of it, and then we'll come back and wrap up on it.
Titled Ohio or Illinois or Florida or something else. So okay, here's the first four columns. Mitch, take us through us. What's the process here?
So this is just a handful. I want to make that point. This is a handful of 1,030 roughly school districts across Texas.
Yep.
But the point that you're making is that when you realize, and this is what everybody in the United States must look at, because these two numbers will literally tell you how big the fraud is in your school district. So what we've done with this is we grabbed the data initially. There were two of these charts, and one of them was one set of values from the Bond Review Board, which Governor Abbott is the chairman. And the other came from the right hand of the Texas government called the Texas Education Agency. Well, what this is showing you and what everybody should be doing, because this tells the truth, if you go and look in your local school district for outstanding bonds, you will find that information in most cases. We found it.
And all right, so right at the top here, Mitch, we have Aledo ISD, some kind that stands for what? What does that stand for, ISD?
Independent School District.
Okay, population 31,966 in this district, 9,598 students, total debt outstanding, looks like 367 million and some other numbers. So they have $367 million in debt on top of a population of 31,000?
Yes, but it gets worse. So keep going and you'll see how much that is per house.
Okay.
See, the trick to this is look
so
at
So I just want to make
house.
Sure. So we got those first four columns. Yep. We understand how to read those, and we got McKinney in here, Plano. We just have a selection of school districts. This is the same chart, but cut in the middle. So now we have a cost per student. What does that mean, 38,285?
We have found across the United States, and I am willing to bet right now that there isn't a single school district who can answer one question. The one question is, how much does it cost to educate a child from grade 1 to grade 4? Educate a child from grade 1 to grade 7? I don't care what the numbers are. Just answer the question. How much does it cost? Well, the reality is they can't answer the question, or they refuse to answer it. Your choice. But that is a huge problem, and that proves that the money isn't going to the students.
But is that a yearly cost
mechanism?
Is that what does that mean? 38,285 cost per student. Is that per year?
Yes.
What? Okay.
Before I drop this image down, I want to, Chris is astounded that one of these places are spending over $30,000 a year per student out on the school. Now, if you look up how much money we spend per student in the state of Texas, it's right around $20,000. I'm going to tell you that the numbers you see here are in addition to that. This is additional spending. And I want to read a few of these numbers to you, how much they're spending per student at some of these schools, because the graph is cut off for those on the audio only. I can't read the numbers, or I can't tell you who's doing it. But there's a lot of people doing it. $80,505,000 a year per student. $88,306 a year per student. For those watching this, I'm on lines 4 and 5. I'm going to go down to just below the $16,000, $41,000, $42,000, $63,000, $25,000, skipping over $78,000. Skipping way down, because there's a lot of like 14,000, 15,000 numbers in there, 74,000, 61,000, 27,000. Okay, the schools are nice. I'm going to tell you, like I said, some of these schools are, when you see them, like in a video tour or something, you're visually stunning what they're putting in. But they are not spending 60 grand per student of money that's going to truly educate that student. This is everybody's slush fund bullshit. This is kickbacks to the guy that's getting some ridiculous amount of money to put the AstroTurf in at the school stadium, and somehow that guy that owns the company that does the AstroTurf for the school stadium happens to be somebody's brother-in-law or son-in-law. All right, this is a grift that you can't even understand. The big thing here is the money to fix this does not exist. If you watch the whole video, and there's a link in the audio notes, down in the video notes, there's a link that will go over to the audio side. That will be up about 30 minutes after I finish the live stream. So if you're watching live, you'll have to wait till that's done. But if you keep listening to this, the man that's being talked to, this Vexler guy, he makes an incredible case that the value of these bonds is 20 to 30 cents on the dollar. 20 to 30 cents on the dollar. And again, I want you to understand, like, oh, Jack, you're in Texas. I thought Texas had its shit together. Texas has its shit together a lot better probably than most states. And we have this problem. Translation, everybody has this problem. And some people have a much bigger version of this problem. I am going to do something here. Okay, there we go. We're not here for you to try to save everybody from themselves, bro. somebody mentioned Bucks County, Pennsylvania, and it's a very, very wealthy area near Philadelphia, not Philadelphia proper, but near Philadelphia. And they said that those people don't have more money or more income. They have more debt, and that's why they look wealthy. And I think there's a big part of that being true. But you want to talk about a place where the numbers that are in Texas look tame, look to that area. Look to Bucks County, Pennsylvania. You know, look to Buckhead down near Atlanta, Georgia. Look to, you know, some of your upper end areas of like North and South Carolina. And those are not even the worst. Then go look at California. Go look at Los Angeles. Go look at Los Angeles and San Francisco. Go look at Seattle. Go look at Chicago. It should terrify you. There's so many things people are terrified of that it's like, just relax, it's going to be okay. This actually should terrify you. This is, sooner or later, one of these or two of these are going to go, like two little pops, and they're going to be connected to something else, and it's going to go pop, pop. And then boom, 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 boom. A long time ago, I did an episode called The Quadrillion Dollar Derivatives Landmines. This is a huge part of that. It only takes one space for all these. These are all derivatives of derivatives, right? And I'll explain that a little bit in a second. It only takes like one pops, and then it's connected to another one, and that pops, and then this one pops because they're all leveraged against each other. Do you know how in 2000, well, some of you do and some of you don't. In 2008, part of the mortgage crisis was they were making all these mortgages to people who couldn't actually pay their debts. Sound familiar? And everybody thought, well, they'll pay their debts. They have to. It's their house. Everybody pays your mortgage before you pay anything else. No, they don't. You know, like they eat before they pay their mortgage. People will pay their car payment before they pay their mortgage when it comes right down to it. Because if I have my car and I can eat, I can get an apartment. And screw the house, because that's the way people in America think. I remember what was going on, and I'm like, and I was telling people, it's not that simple. Well, just give the house back. It's not a pair of jeans you're returning to Walmart. So they couldn't pay the debt, but what was making it worse is Company A would issue the debt, the mortgage, and they would make the fee off the top, and they would sell the mortgage to another company, Company B. Company B would buy thousands and thousands of these mortgages and put together a fund, and they would sell it to Company C, who had investors, which was the average Joe on the street with bonds, right? Real estate bonds. And then they would cut that up into pieces and make another vehicle that was pieces of pieces, and they did it again and again and again. When the whole real estate crisis hit, what you thought was the economy went into meltdown mode, like Three Mile Island or some shit, because people didn't pay their debts. If all it was is people not paying their debts, and all it was is one level, the bank that issued the loan now has to repossess the house. If that's all it was, it wouldn't have been that big of a deal. It certainly wouldn't have been the Great Recession. What it was is boom, 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 all these banks, all these institutions holding all this toxic debt in packages that were packaged, repackaged, and repackaged. The Big Short, totally watch it if you haven't. That's what happened there. And the United States federal government came into the tune of trillions of dollars to bail it all out. We can't do it again. This is the same thing, but worse. If you watch the whole video, there's points where he says, well, like in this town right here, basically every property owner is on the hook for $1,200 a month in interest payments. My freaking house payment's well under $2,000, guys. Well, that's going to piss some people off. And it's more taxes than principal and interest, by the way. Okay? I have no PMI because I have enough equity. I don't even have any PMI. But I am paying more for taxes than principal, interest, and insurance, honestly. Taxes are the biggest part of my housing expense. And it ain't $1,200 a month. I'll move before that shit happens. How are we going to do this? We're not. So this guy's proposal to fix it sounds really drastic until you really think about it. The abolishment of property tax. That's the first step. What? How would that work? Well, the schools would stop being able to do this. If every time they wanted a new thingamajob or a new shiny or whatever, they couldn't just, let's have a bond initiative, right? If they couldn't tax your property, they couldn't do it. Then we need a state sales tax of 15%. Then you force the districts to declare bankruptcy and sell off the bonds at 30 cents on the dollar because that's what they're worth. And you know who gets hurt, though? The schools. Nope. Nope. It's not a company. It's a public school. It's not going anywhere. And it gives the districts who need to close campuses cover to do so. Because while they're building these giant schools, the school population's going down. Another problem altogether, right? Texas is a little bit converse because we have a growing population of people moving here because we're perceived as better because we're back to the least stinky shirt in the hamper, right? We're probably like Florida and Texas are probably the two best states to be living in right now. It doesn't mean that we're good. It's just we're not as bad as y'all, okay? So you have this 15% sales tax for 3 years. He's got the math worked out, and then it goes down to like 10, and it's like 8 right now. So it's not that much more, but no real estate tax at all. Not for the schools, not for the hot, nothing. Everything is funded with a 10% state sales tax. That's it. It's all you get. And if it doesn't work, then you need to live within your means like anybody else. I don't know that'll happen. That's his proposed solution. Here's my issue with that solution. I'm actually for that. I think that would be a much better. At first, I'm like, wait a minute. What's sales tax going to cost me on this or that? And then I look at it and go, yeah, but I'm not going to spend over $6,000 a year on freaking property tax. So, okay. And I control my sales tax. I control what I buy. I have ways around that, right? I can buy from the secondary market. There's all kinds of things I can do to cut my sales tax cost down. And then it goes down. And I immediately see relief. The only way I see that working, if they do it, and I'm not saying they will, but the only way I see it working, you would have to have a rider on the bill creating this policy. And it would have to be, if you are a landlord, you get to stop paying your taxes when you send us an affidavit showing that you stop passing through the expense to your tenant. In other words, if I had collect $10,000 in rent a month and I pay $5,000 in taxes, then I need to cut my rent down to $5,000 a month. However many tenants in my multi-occupancy building that is, whatever that is. In other words, I have to pass it through and I have to do it immediately. And the way you enforce it is until we can see that you've done it, you just keep paying your property taxes, bitch. You can either stop paying the taxes or you can keep paying the taxes. We don't really care. Because as soon as somebody does it, everybody's going to do it. Because people are like, tenants are going to be pissed. They're going to know, hey, when am I getting my cut? And the tenants will rat out the landlord if they don't pass it through. Now, I'm sure the landlord might still raise your rent like $30 or something for other expenses or whatever. But that's going to be a fraction of what renters would pay. So everybody has. Because this would be no real estate taxes. Not on companies, not on people, not on landlords, nobody. And I think that would actually work, but Mick says, didn't they have a ballot initiative to eliminate property tax there, but it failed? No, not here. Not here. All we've ever done is talk about it. The place that happened was either North or South Dakota. It was one of the two Dakotas, and it was the teachers. The teachers' unions got together, and they brought in money from all over the country. Right. Like the teacher unions pumped money into advertising campaigns. terrifying the people. If you do this, your children will be wearing paper bags to school. They'll die. There'll have to be death squads to kill some of the students because there's going to be too many students for what we have available, so we'll just have to kill your children. Like, it wasn't that bad, but it was damn near that bad, and they scared them out of it. But this would have a – like, the thing about the Dakota one was just no taxes. They didn't say how they were going to pay for anything without them. I think that was a big part of why it failed. You have to explain how you're going to maintain the service you have. Either we're getting rid of it, we're downscaling it, or we're keeping it, and here's how we're going to fund it. But right now, this is the biggest economic threat to the United States of America as a whole. The $37 trillion national debt pales in comparison to this problem, which exists in almost every municipality in the country. The only place this doesn't exist is where they have like a school with 10 kids in it. That's the only place that it doesn't exist. And those places are always dependent on all the places around them that that's not the case. This is the biggest risk you have. If you are not holding any real assets in this situation, I mean, you're going to destroy the value of property with it as well. Sooner or later, there's going to be massive property owner protesting. There was a time in this country, and there were other requirements as well, but only property owners could vote. When you look at this, you can see why that was why they did that in the first place. They did it because they hate black people. Shut up. That was true in the northern states with no slavery. It was true after slaves were freed to a degree for a while. The rights as we know them as voting rights today evolved over time. But one of the key constraints was if you didn't own property, you didn't vote. You could own a little postage stamp lump, you could vote. You had to be rich, but you had to have your stake in the game. And I'm not saying that that would fix anything, but I can see some justification for it. On that, let's move on to another thing that's happened in this country over the years: the creation of the two-income family as a default. I want to be very clear what I'm talking about here. I am not saying women belong naked and barefoot and in the kitchen. I guarantee you people are going to cut this video up and cut out where it says I'm not saying, and they're going to make me say it as though I'm saying that's exactly what I'm saying, because that's just how effed up people are in the head. I'm not saying that. I'm not saying women shouldn't work. I'm not saying that some women aren't fantastic at their jobs. I'm saying we live in a society today where it is considered like a woman would actually be looked down on for saying, I just want to go home, have a few children, and raise them. And the way that I'll contribute to my family is I will give my children all the love in the world. I will be there for them every step of the way. I will be the mom that goes to the PTA meetings. I will be the mom that holds their hand. I will hug them when they cry. I will walk them to the front door of the school on the first day of kindergarten. I will be standing there when they move the tassel from one side to the other. I want to be a mom before anything else. I might even have a part-time job here and there and do some things to earn some money, but job number one, mom. If a woman said that in 1970, people went, yeah, of course. If a woman says that today, it's not okay. The general consensus is it's not okay to be that person. That's a sickness. I'm not saying you have to be that person. I'm not saying that it should not be okay if the woman says the complete opposite. I want to work. I want a career. I believe I can have it all, whatever. I don't want to get married. I don't want to have kids. Your choice is your choice. I'm saying that we have literally turned one of the most virtuous things a woman can do into a negative in the court of public opinion in society over the last 50 years. And I think it's a huge mistake. As I said, you go back to 75 and back. In America, except for the war years, when women went to work because they had to, because all the men went to the war, right, in World War II, traditionally in this country, and this goes back into the 1800s, this statistic, 70% of families were single-income families. And about 10% of the 30% that were two-income families, about one-third of those, the woman's income was not really significant to the total income of the household. In other words, she had a part-time job. She worked summers when the kids were out of school, or something like that, right? Like, you know, doing like watching the other kids and making like entrepreneurial things and stuff like that. But they were not full-time careers. So only about 20% of women that were in marital relationships prior to 1975 had full-time jobs. Today, it's probably 80%. And let's just look at all the problems that that brought to us. What did we gain? What are we better for because of it? Diversity is our strength. Women can do everything men can do, whatever. Like, don't give me some freaking rah-rah slogan. Don't give me some fucking catchphrase. Tell me how society is better for it. Will a woman who wants to, that was always allowed. That was always allowed. There were female billionaires at a time when you were super effing, you were richy rich rich as a millionaire. There were women billionaires. I'm not saying that there weren't some things holding women back, and I'm not saying it's not good those things were taken away. I'm okay with that. But women who really, what about the 20% that did? What about the 20% that did? If they could, then others could too. There's a funny thing about this. If a woman does not have her mind riddled with all of this sense of obligation, like you have to go out and work, you have to have a career. A lot of women, if just left to themselves, would really like to raise some children and have a family. And anybody who's ever raised children knows that it's a full-time job. It really is. And the way this used to work, honestly, and a huge portion of the women with careers, they were post-young mom when they went into those careers. They maybe had an education, they did some things and whatever. And as the kids moved toward the high school years, middle school and high school, like you had one kid that's like about to graduate, another kid that's like a sophomore, another kid that's like in eighth grade, and they don't really need you all the time anymore, then mom would be like, you know, it might be great. It might help us get quicker into retirement years if I took a job down at the store or something like that. So they would go out and look for a job, and they would generally, you know, find something. Because since most women didn't work, there weren't as many people in the workplace, so employers had more demand for workers. It's just how it worked. It worked pretty well. It worked pretty damn well. So again, I'm not saying let's send all the women back to the kitchen, even though that's what people are going to say when they hear this. I'm not saying we should put any restrictions on the ability of a woman to enter the workplace or whatever. But God, I'm going to tell you that I think about, you know, the number thrown around is like 50%. I'm going to be more conservative. I'm going to say about 30% of jobs today are completely unnecessary. I think we have at least 30% of our jobs without making any structural changes. Like, we'll get to 50%, but just out of the gate, right now, if you selectively, like if you had, like, remember Bruce Almighty, Jim Carrey was in it, he becomes God for like a few weeks or whatever, where you could see everything and know everything, and you know, you sent one email and answered all the prayers and it caused a mess. Like, if you could just like somehow be like a godlike entity and selectively pick 3 out of 10 people to eliminate, not get rid of them, just you don't have a job anymore. And they all just disappeared from the workplace. Nothing would happen. All the trucks would still roll. All the stuff would still ship. All the statements would get made. All the things that actually matter. All the food would still end up on the plate. It would be okay. Nothing bad would happen. I'll put it this way. In most businesses with 10 employees, there's 3 you can eliminate, and the business will still function. Didn't Elon Musk eliminate something like 80% of the Twitter workforce when he turned it into X? Everything still worked. What did these people do? And I know I'm going to get slack for this, but this is the way I see it. The vast majority of useless jobs are occupied by women and effeminate men. Men that if you told them to change a spark plug in a vehicle, they'd have to first find out what a spark plug is. Then they'd have to find out what a spark plug wrench is and why you need one. Then they'd have to find out where the spark plug is. And if they fumbled their way all the way through it, they'd have to do it a second time because they wouldn't know to set a fucking gap in the spark plug. Those kind of guys. Now, not every guy like that's job is useless, but a lot of them are. So many of these people, what is your job really all about? They go to meetings. They fill out forms. They spend time bullshitting, but they maybe do 4 hours of work in an 8-hour day. They take vacation for 2 weeks. No one even notices they're gone. How important can you be? Just by eliminating those jobs, that's a shitload of people not going to work. And there are people, why doesn't the husband stay home? Okay. You really think so? You know, first of all, I just think, generally speaking, not always, but generally speaking, women tend to be better suited for that. We are biologically different, no matter what the TV and the social media tells you. Women are more nurturing with young children. They have a softer side to them. It's necessary in dealing with kind of that growth from like 2 to 6 is tough. And, you know, children tend to respond really well to men. 7 and above, like where we crack down and like, you know, put a foot in the ass, and it's necessary when they hit that rebellious stage. But that approach that works really good at that stage of growth doesn't work well on a 4-year-old at all. It just doesn't. It's overkill. That's how we balance each other. It's like, it's kind of like we evolved as a species for women and men to serve different roles in the hierarchy and the structure of the family. I know that's crazy talk. It's not like monkeys do the same thing. It's not like lions do the same. Oh, shit, wait a minute. Yeah, they do. That's your science, liberal. Shouldn't you love that shit? Right? Don't you love nature? Don't you think we should be more natural in the way that we act? Do you see dad babysitting the infant gorilla and trying to breastfeed it? No? Okay. Maybe you should pay attention to learn something. I'm just saying maybe it's time that we slide away from it being the default. That it's not about what women can and cannot do. It's that maybe we should value the woman who chooses to be a mother and a wife first in her life instead of this absolute – we degrade them. We make like it's weird. The woman that says, I want it all, she gets mad at that woman. Why? She didn't tell you, you can't go to your job. She said, I chose to live this way. Go live the way you want. And they get mad. It's very interesting when you look at that dynamic. Who is it that gets mad in a situation when somebody says or does something? The trad wife trend, right? All the liberal, by the way, uggos. I'm sorry. I know I'm not supposed to judge people that way, but it's all the uggos, right? It's all the ones that, you know, they say I'm going on a sex strike and guys are like, okay. It's all of them. They're all pissed. Right. Or some of them are pretty and they're the kind of like anchor woman type look and all. And they're pissed, too. Why are you pissed? If the person said, you know, I'm a woman, but I'm a garbage man. You go, girl. I'm a woman and I choose to raise my children first. Oh, what's wrong with you? And I think we're starting to see the first inklings of this happening. And part of it is we are having a come to Jesus moment with the fact that we are overemployed. We're overemployed. We do not need this many people working because many of the people working aren't actually producing or doing anything meaningful. This whole like AI is going to come and take all our jobs, right? All our jobs. They took our jobs, right? We already have about half the workforce. It's unnecessary. Remember I said it's 30%? That's straight up, we don't change anything. Go to what the fuck happened or WTF happened in 1971.com and look at every single instance of every industry where we have problems. The cost of education, the cost of healthcare, et cetera, legal fees, et cetera. Administrators blew through the roof in employment. We had almost none of these people in 1970. There's more administrators in medicine today than doctors and nurses combined. There's more Karens than doctors in the medical industry. There's more Karens than nurses in the medical industry. There's more Karens in administration in the education system than legitimate teachers. This all came with fiat money. none of those jobs are actually necessary. So if you actually changed the system, because a lot of this was make work, right? It's our version of the Great Wall of China. People think the Great Wall of China kept out the Mongolians. It didn't know such thing. It was a giant make-work project. The emperor's got problems. I know we'll build a wall. We'll keep out the Mongolians. Sire, the Mongolians really are not that big of a problem. Yeah, but they don't know that. They'll believe whatever we tell them. Well, you have a point. How are we going to pay for it? We have a bunch of silver. What we'll do is we'll devalue the silver. We'll take all the coins in tax, and we'll remint them, and we'll take down the cost of production of a coin, and we'll reissue them and say they're worth the same amount of money. Won't they get mad? They won't know. They won't figure it out for a while. And we'll pay people to build this wall. That'll give them all something to do, and they'll all shut up and leave us alone and let us live our life of luxury. That was the make-work project, and it was done everywhere. They did it in Egypt. You think they built all that shit because they actually needed it? They did it in Rome. Yeah, they built the aqueduct. That was valuable infrastructure that brought water to the cities. Great. 90% of the shit they built, they didn't need it. They need it. If you keep people occupied and engaged and employed, they're happy. So what do? We created an entire sector of the economy that would be best described as adult daycare. It's some place for people that don't have any other real function to go and do and feel like they're contributing to society. So if you cut the number of people working by half, because that's about how many people we actually need working, you'd have a balance. And it would stop making sense for families to be double income families. It would. They created a system that economically labored people into going to work. If you were a woman and you wanted a job, and even 1980, if you wanted a job, you could get one. You could get one. Don't let anybody tell you otherwise. Because there were a lot of us that were latchkey kids by the 80s. But there were still a shitload of women that didn't go to work. And it wasn't because their husband said, my wife won't have a job. They didn't freaking want to. I had friends with wholesome families like that. That's part of why I'm not a complete degenerate, because I at least had some good influences around me. And I remember the stay-at-home moms, and I remember how they took care of their kids, and how they made them lunch on weekends and shit like that. Yes, they threw us out of the house, but they let us in to feed us. They didn't throw us out of the house because they hated us and didn't have time for us. They knew that we were better off outside than inside. They wanted us to go out and explore. They wanted us to grow. They wanted us to learn. Not everybody was a latchkey kid in the 80s. I was, but not everybody was. There were a lot of women who stayed home with their families. By the 90s, it was almost gone. And by the early 2000s, forget about it. Today, if a woman says, they say, well, what do you do? I'm a stay-home mom. People look at her, admit it. Even those of you that think it's a good thing, there's still a little piece of you like going, what's your husband do? How much money does he make? How much is he killing himself so you can stay home? Even those of us that know better, there's a little piece of us that feels that way. And why? We've been programmed society to think that way. But I think you can only live counter to reality for so long before the universe starts to right the ship. And I think that's starting to happen. And I think it has to happen now. Because there are a lot of these makeshift bullshit jobs. They're the first ones that AI is going to take away, because it's all clerical bullshit. That's not really necessary. Anyway, moving on. Kids could come home from school for lunch. I don't ever remember that, Lee, and I know you grew up in Jacksonville like me. I don't ever remember that. You know what I do remember, though? I do remember, especially when I was in Catholic school before I managed to get thrown out the first time. Yes, first, because there were two times. I remember parents who came and had lunch with their kids. Now, they wouldn't do this in like 7th, 8th grade because that would be embarrassing. But, you know, like little kids when they like their parents around their friends when they're like 1st grade, 2nd grade, 3rd. I remember that, but I don't remember ever being able to go home for lunch. But I guess depending on where the school was and the neighborhood was, like I'm thinking of like where my son went to school when he was in grade school in Texas. It was literally a 3-minute walk from our house to his school. I could see that being possible with knowledge of it. And she says, depending on the neighborhood. Okay, cool. My last one, though, the Texas Democrats, they ran away. They're going home. They said they were going to go, and they said, no, we're not. And they said, we're going to go, and they said, no, we're not. Now they're like, okay, we completely disrupted one session. We made our point. Now we're going home, which means absolutely nothing. I think when Abbott said, I will immediately reconvene another special session, they didn't believe it. They're like, well, surely like next week. And no, Abbott's like, this session has ended. This new session has begun. Boom. And they're like, okay, you got to understand something. If you're a Texas representative in our state house, you do not earn your money by being a state representative. You earn it off grift, graft, and some sort of a job you do. We are a part-time legislature. The actual salary of a Texas legislator is $6,000 a year. When you get called into session, there's a per diem of like $200-something a day. And when you work that out, they only go into normal, regular sessions every other year for about 100 days, and they make less money for being a representative in the House for the state of Texas than a manager at 7-Eleven makes. And when you're not in session, you're not getting your per diem, and you're getting fined $500. Even when you got somebody out there like Beto O'Rourke saying, I'm raising money to pay your fines for you, you still have an economic problem here. And it's not necessarily clear that giving them the money to do that with is legal. I guess they could directly pay the fines. That's still an income because I've offset your obligation. So then they have to pay taxes on that money. You see, this is not as clean as they tried to make it look. That's why this has always been done in limited duration. This is why it's never worked. And what I mean by never worked is, as I've said previously, the first time I listened on the radio as a young man and I heard the Texas Democrats ran away. They went to New Mexico and stayed in a shit fleabag motel just across the border in the state of New Mexico was 1994. And they've done it many times. They did it. The last time they did before this one was just 4 years ago in 2021. They ran away again. And they've done it a lot. And it's never worked. It's never worked. Not once. And what I mean by not worked is eventually they came back and whatever they were trying to stop happened anyway. You're not going to win that fight in Texas. Again, the last time, this is why 1994, the last time that a Republican won a statewide race in Texas was 91. It was 91 or 92. It was Ann Richards. And when she ended up running later against George Bush Jr. and he won, that was the last statewide Democrat in office in this state. We have Republican and Democrat mayors. We have Democrats on city councils and stuff like that. We have Democrats in the federal House. But senators are statewide. Governors are statewide. Lieutenant governors are statewide. People like railroad commissioners, which is way more powerful than you think in Texas, not limited to the railroad. All the statewide offices, since George Bush was governor in Texas, have never been won by a Democrat. That's how red Texas is. When people say, it's turning purple. No, it isn't. No, it isn't. And that track record tells you this is the reddest of red states. The only state redder than Texas is Oklahoma. Oklahoma doesn't have a Democrat anything. They don't have a Democrat dog catcher in Oklahoma. Texas is the second reddest state, and we're actually big enough for that to matter. So when the Republicans decide they're going to do something in this state, they're going to do it. And they govern like a bunch of wusses. They won't fix this property tax problem I talked about. Don't think I'm saying it's good. They won't do anything. The Democrats won't do anything either. But there's one thing the Democrats will do that the Republicans won't do most of the time. Play dirty. Even within the rules, play dirty within the rules. I have a friend, very close friend I've mentioned. His name's David. Mentioned many times on the show. We share a very similar background. And part of that is a childhood background in martial arts at a competitive level where we went to tournaments. And, you know, I say fought in tournaments. It was, I don't think a 3-point match is really a fight. It's more like a match. Like occasionally somebody gets knocked the hell out or something with one good crack. But, you know, it's a punch lands break and then you award a point, right? And you wear pads. It's not like Karate Kid bullshit or something, right? But there, you can't hit the legs. And if you hit the legs, the penalty is a half a point. So what he would do and what they did in his group, they would come in immediately and like drop a heel into your thigh. Well, you take a half point penalty, but it's legal because that's what the rule says happens. Now this person, basically you frogged his quad, right? That's what we used to call it too, because we knew about this. We just didn't. Our sensei wasn't hip on us doing shit like this unless the other side was. That's how he was. David was the guy that would do it first. So like you come in, you just hammer somebody right in the quad muscle. Now you're not, it's not sweeping the leg, right? It's not kicking the knee like Danielson, right? It is just, it's painful. It's not a serious lasting injury. It just hurts. And what it does is you really have a hard time then for a few minutes, and these matches don't last more than a few minutes, putting weight on that leg. It's tender. It hurts. And now it's in your head. So you gave up the half point. So now you're half to zero, negative half to zero. But then you have a really good chance of winning because you've actually temporarily disabled your opponent. That's playing dirty within the rules. Okay? It's dirty, but it's in the rules. Democrats excel at dirty within the rules and dirty on the outside of the rules. Republicans have this, like I said, it's like Federations versus Romulans, right? Like this, that's, we follow Robert's rules of order, right? Like you can't do that when your opponent doesn't, but that's what Texas Republicans do. So are there dirty tricks that the Republicans could play when this reconvenes? I think so. I think so. Here would be one. So the Texas Constitution and the rules of the state house say that if you are a Democrat and you run away from a vote, the sergeant at arms of the house can issue an arrest warrant, and DPS, this is state troopers, these are cops, can go get you and put you back in your seat. You don't go to jail, right? You don't go before a judge, but it's an arrest. By every definition of the word, a man with a gun can and will, up to the point of use physical force and put handcuffs on you, choke hold your ass to the ground and sit you in your seat and say, you shall do your duty. This is legal within the state of Texas. There's no reason that the entire back of the house couldn't just be sitting, like 40 state troopers just standing there like this on the next time the house convenes. And when the speaker stands up and says, these are the items on the agenda today, and they get up, sit the fuck down. You're not going anywhere. You're staying right where you are. And then ram through a bunch of shit, including like rules changes. You know the $500 fine per day? If it's judged to be a willful abandonment of your seat, it's now $10,000 a day. Eyes have it. Next item on the agenda. They could do something like that. I don't think they can change the rule because it's a constitutional rule that says that if you don't have the quorum, you can't take a vote. And I don't think you could really force a vote and have a legal law saying that they have abdicated their seats. What the legislature can do is propose a ballot amendment. And if they have a majority vote, they can force it into the election. So they could then, next item on the agenda, a new constitutional amendment, a couple sentences, reads as follows. If a member of the Texas House abdicates their seats to prevent a vote for a period of greater than 20 consecutive days, they have in fact abdicated their seat and they are no longer necessary for quorum, the legislature shall continue without them. And a special election shall be held as soon as possible to make up for the lack of representation. But the legislature doesn't have to wait on it. Put that on the ballot. Put that on the ballot in the state of Texas. Trust me, it's been 35 years of these assholes running away. Every time they're going to lose, it will pass. They can't do it, but they can make it happen. And there's a ton of other shit they could do. They could create other consequences for running away. They could create the ability to arrest and detain after return after exceeding a certain number of days, right? Because the provision in the Texas Constitution, the Democrats today say, the founders of Texas gave this to us in substitute for a filibuster. Okay, bitches, first of all, it applies to the House, and the House nowhere has a filibuster, okay? No, they did not. They did this to prevent the kind of dirty-ass shit that today's Democrat Party does, which would be something like calling a session but not telling everybody. That's why they did it. When this was put in place, we didn't have cars. You're a rep from Lubbock in a part-time legislature. You're back in Lubbock putting a shoe on a horse. The governor calls a special session, and nobody told you. It takes a long time to ride a horse from Lubbock to Austin. So it was put in place so that you couldn't pull these backdoor deals at night. Now it's being abused. It is what it is. The rules are the rules. We have to follow the rules. Doesn't mean we can't play a little bit dirty. Excellent. This is what the Republicans would do if they governed like the Democrats. Am I saying they should? I'm saying that maybe they should. I'm saying that maybe you should then work with the Democrats and go, if you don't like this, if you don't like that we're playing dirty within the boundaries of the rules, then maybe we should make it so we all have to actually follow the real rules and the real spirit of the law. Maybe a concession could be made that gives the Democrats some level of power, since they're always out of power in Texas, some level of ability to negotiate. But at the same time, if you run away and don't do your job, you don't get to shut down the company, because that's what they're doing. Anyway, I don't know how that's all going to work out. I usually close, do my closing segment and then do questions. I only caught one question today with my one good eye, but J-Reg says, any thoughts on a new proposed changes to 401k plan, example, buying real estate, crypto within your 401k? Don't get excited about it. It hasn't changed a fucking thing yet. I already covered this about a week ago. I guess you didn't make that show. You can't go buy real estate in your 401k right now. And even with the new rule, you probably can't buy real estate and live in it. Just the way that you can't buy real estate with your IRA and live in it. You have to use it as an income generating property, and you can't personally benefit from it other than it going into your retirement account for it to stay. And you can lose a shitload if you don't. John Pugliano covered that. The real estate thing is more like alternative real estate assets, like, buying a bunch of these shitty ass bonds that we just said you probably shouldn't buy. Crypto. Stop saying crypto. Stop saying crypto. Ugh. The mountain of shit that opens up. Bitcoin and maybe other crypto assets, I guess. That's not in there yet either. Like, all this was the president saying that the government needs to investigate opening this up. And it didn't actually do anything yet. The importance of that legislation is the stuff that is available to 401k plans right now, but plan administrators are not putting it in there. There is no legal reason right now, for instance, for a plan administrator of a 401k to not say, you know what, we're going to add IBIT, BlackRock's Bitcoin ETF, to this, and maybe some other publicly traded funds and assets that are available that aren't really alternative, but they're seen alternative because of the class of the asset. Government guidance until that EO was issued by Trump was basically like, you can do it, but you really shouldn't. So before that EO, any 401k could have added IBIT, but they were opening up a whole legal can of worms, because if something went wrong because of it, if some sort of class action was launched in because of it, you can see just at a deposition, that plan administrator being asked, didn't you read the federal guidance on this? Didn't you see that these were highly risky and that people's retirement accounts should not be in them? Didn't you read that before you did this? Well, that all went away, because that was all from an EO. That was Biden era bullshit. That's all gone now. There's no legitimate reason to keep I always say IBIT because it's the one I remember, right? But, there's a bunch of companies that have. There's like 11 of them. There's no reason for any plan administrator to tell the customer now you can't have one of those in your 401k plan. So that's the big change there. But the other stuff that people are talking about, it's not coming anytime soon. With that, let's go ahead and wrap up today real quick. As we do so, I want to tell you about the item of the day today. And this is kind of a cool one and a bit of a different one for me. I do a lot with tools, I guess, but this is a socket set that I didn't actually plan on putting on T-Spaz initially. I was sitting down one day and I thought to myself, self, you're going to travel somewhere, beyond the beer store with your car, and you should take tools with yourself. And so go get your tools out of the shop and put tools in your car. So if something goes wrong on the way, you have tools with you. And I thought, I should probably have tools with me all the time. And I have some. But like a socket set, like I have a really nice socket set, much bigger than this one in my shop, and I don't keep it in my car or my truck. But if I'm going somewhere long distance, then I'm like, maybe you should just have. So I'm like, I wonder what it would cost for a good, decent socket set that's not a piece of shit, right? Not a total piece of garbage. The first time I put, you know, any serious torque on it, it's going to snap and break and strip or what have you. And so I started looking like, what is the best quality available socket set that's affordable and designed to be used with impact tools? Because I always also keep a DeWalt cordless impact tool in my vehicle as well. I keep a 2 amp hour battery in there, and about once a month I just take that battery and throw it in a charger and take one and put it back, and I keep an extra charger there so I can plug it into the vehicle and charge it up if I need to. And I started checking all these different brands, and a lot of it was absolute shit. A lot of the high quality discount stuff, you might as well just buy, you know, Husky or Craftsman, because it's not priced competitively enough to give up any quality. Well, then I found this company called Easily, and they've only been around since 2021. I'm sure they manufacture in China, but the reviews were badass, and they was impact ready tools, and the set itself included an impact adapter. So you have to buy one of those, and that means you can take any socket in here and take that little impact tool and use it with it. And then, so I bought it, and then I threw it in my truck. I actually bought two of them. One's in the truck behind the seat, and the other one is in the car, in the trunk. And a couple weeks ago, my wife bought a new weight bench, and I had to put it together, you know, and I went and got the socket set, and immediately, like, go get the impact tool. And so I've used it on a few different projects and stuff now just to try it out. The quality of this tool set is fantastic. 64 pieces, metric and SAE, adapters, joints, offsets, and everything that you could possibly need in a set. Deep and shallow socket, 64 piece. The ratchet feels just good in the hand. It has a good tight ratcheting mechanism. There's no play in it. And this set is $60. Right? I mean, a set like that for $60 is a good deal. Is it cheap? No. What would the same set cost in like a name brand? $120. Of this quality, at least $120. I can't tell the difference. It's about half the price for the same quality. You know, maybe if you're some sort of tool snob or something, if you're the favorite customer of the Snap-on tool guy that drives the van, you might have a problem. The kind of things you use a set like this for, I can't see it ever being a problem. I am blown away. And when I read the reviews were all good. And the ones that weren't good were from like special people. I'll leave it at that. And people that think that it's the manufacturer's responsibility to tell the UPS driver what to do. Like, when I see 1- and 2-star reviews and their complaints about the UPS driver threw it over the fence into a puddle, I think you're complaining in the wrong place. That should be a complaint to UPS, not to Amazon and the guy that made the tool set, because they had nothing to do with that. That is not an Amazon problem. It's certainly not a manufacturer problem. Anyway, this is a great set. Check it out. The write-up's over at thesurvivalpodcast.com, and you can always help support us no matter what if you do your shopping starting at tspaz.com. But that, we're at 2 hours, man. I thought it was going to be a short show today. I guess, you know, when you love what you do, you don't mind doing it. So happy to be here with you guys. Tomorrow we'll have something else. I don't even know what we're going to do tomorrow yet. Olga from Mushroom Mountain is coming back on Wednesday. This will be like the last of the mushroom shows for a while. We kind of did like a mushroom series. Olga's coming back, and instead of talking about growing mushrooms or gardening with mushrooms or how to use Bloxmon and all that this time, we're going to talk about specifically the medicinal value of mushrooms, which will be great for people that want to grow or forage their own medicinals, but also for people who just want to utilize mushrooms for their medicinal properties. Mushrooms are magic, in my opinion, and not just the magic mushrooms that make you trip balls or whatever. Like, in general, when you look at all the things that mushrooms can do, all the things that mushrooms can help us with our health, it's pretty amazing. And even the real magic mushrooms, right, the psychedelics, there's not really a huge amount of people using them for recreational use. That's not really what it's about. The psychedelics, some of the work that I've read, like one of Paul Stamets' most recent books, has blown me away. people with, that have lifelong struggles with depression, PTSD, people that are nearing like end of life due to illness and they're having a hard time accepting it. Like they have a terminal cancer diagnosis, but maybe they have a year and a half to live or whatever. They're doing in just a couple sessions and never again things that are changing these people's lives. Does it work for everybody? No. Does anybody have a negative outcome? Yes, which is true of everything medicine does. Far less so than medicine does, by the way. But some of these people who have lived their whole life miserable, just assholes to people in their lives, depression, narcissism, all of this, they go through one or two or three sessions of this, and it changes them forever. And they never do it again. They never have to. People that have been addicted to substances their whole life, you would think giving them a hallucinogenic, probably not. No, they literally have given up using, you know, substances recreationally to the point of damaging their lives. They take one pill. They have one 24-hour experience that's guided, and it changes them for the better forever. You can see why the pharmaceutical companies wouldn't exactly – like even if they could patent it, they're not in on that because they can't have a customer for life if one or two times and it works and it's over. So we'd be talking about stuff like that to with Olga tomorrow. I also saw somebody here in chat. They want a link to the socket set. And yes, I just threw it in there for you. I don't know if it'll hyperlink and you can actually click on it. But if you go to the Survival Podcast right now, it's the first post anyway. So just go by the site. You can even go tspc.co if you don't want to type in so many letters, or tspaz.com if you want to purchase other things and help support us. Anyway, with that, I'm going to log off. Thank you for being with me today, folks. And we'll have a great and productive rest of the week. Remember, we do have – I'll be gone for a week and a half. When I get back right away, that Monday, we're dropping the ChatGPT course. If you're not on the list, I don't think we took it down yet, the pre-register. We probably should, Tom, if you're listening. But if you're not on that list, you're not getting in. There's over 700 people on the list. There's 100 spots. So if you want, you need to be ready Monday the 8th in the morning to sign up for that. And then that next Saturday, the 13th, we're opening at 9 a.m. Central Standard Time. Sale for the fall workshop. Take care, guys. I'll catch you tomorrow. They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way. Let me show you a better way.